And when you're looking at an industrial control system, we just naturally tend to have a lot older systems because we'll have a process that's actually put into place. And that process is expected to be able to live for 15, 20 years. You get into nuclear, it's like 30 to 50 years, right? So quite often they wrote policies and safety standards to really lock down all of it for that lifespan.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast, where we talk to the people who keep the internet safe. These industry experts share their innovative cyber defense technologies, vital insights into threats, and predictions for the future of cybersecurity. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. This podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud platform, infrastructure for SecOps where everything is built API first. Scale with confidence as your business grows. Start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. My guest today is Justin Searle, Director of ICS Security at InGardens, where he focuses on industrial control system security architecture and penetration testing. Justin has spent years working at the intersection of cybersecurity and critical infrastructure, helping organizations understand and defend the systems that run power grids, utilities, and other industrial environments. He also played a leadership role in the Smart Grid Security Architecture Group that produced NIST Interagency Report 7628 and contributed to initiatives including the Advanced Security Acceleration Project for the Smart Grid and the National Electric Sector Cybersecurity Organization Resources. In addition to his work, his consulting work, Justin is a senior instructor at the SANS Institute and faculty member at IANS, teaching topics ranging from hacking techniques and forensics to intrusion detection. He regularly presents at major international security conferences, including Black Hat, DEF CON, and OWASP, and leads several well-known open-source security projects, including the Samurai Web Testing Framework and the Samurai Security Testing Framework for Utilities. His work focuses on helping organizations better understand and secure the technologies that power modern infrastructure. Justin, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's a real honor to have you.
Well, thank you very much. And it tells me I probably should update my LinkedIn profile too, since the Samurai project has been, Samurai SCFU was renamed as Control Things a number of years ago. So that's on me.
Yeah. And it's sort of on me too. I do admit that I use the robot to help me do a lot of the research for these interviews now. So there's sometimes a little rough spot there.
Oh, no worries. Easy enough to fix via voice.
All right. So the question I always like to start with folks is like, how did you get into cybersecurity, or how did you get into technology? How did that turn into cybersecurity? And I think in your case, how did that become like this niche area of cybersecurity around industrial security?
No, it really is. So, back in high school, back in like the early 90s, I really got into computer science and electronics and was really excited about that field. Kind of fell into that. By the time I graduated from high school, I decided I really wanted to be able to do, basically automation, because I was really excited about merging, programming with electrical engineering. And that was kind of my goal, is become a university professor teaching that material after I taught in high school for a couple of years. And after I started getting into that and started getting into computers and building computers for that time period, I just started seeing a lot of interest for cybersecurity, and that was kind of the new area, and new cyber attacks were coming out in the mid 90s, and DEF CON was starting to kick off, and Black Hat was a little bit after that, and just kind of got wrapped up into the community and just dug in and focused on cybersecurity. In fact, my first full-time job was working for an engineering firm building control cabinetry for water treatment facilities. And after that, then I went into the IT side, and that's where I really started digging into the cybersecurity there. And then just naturally throughout my career, maybe 10 years later, I merged the two together and was part of that kind of cutting edge doing cybersecurity and OT.
So you always had that interest in the electrical engineering side. So it's kind of makes sense that those two things come together at some point.
Yeah, no, definitely true.
For listeners that may not be familiar, how would you explain what ICS security actually is versus what I think most of our listeners are familiar with, like the IT side of security?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. So when we talk about ICS, right, it's just industrial control systems. So it's doing any type of cybersecurity work with computer systems that run industrial control systems like manufacturing plants, electric grid, oil and gas. But probably the easier way to try to divide that line, because industrial is kind of a vague term and there's not a clear delineation exactly what that is. The easiest way to think about it is any type of control system. So if you have a computer controlling something in the real world, right, even if it's something like a smart thermostat in your house, right? That's kind of where that boundary sits between IT and what we say OT is the more broad term, operations technology, meaning we're actually controlling something with the computers in the real world.
In the industrial environment, there's a hard separation between those two, right? I think that's a Purdue model. Is that what they call it?
Correct. So once again, so when we do an architectural defensive model, what we try to do is we actually try to create a delineation or a demarcation point between IT and OT. And that's not always clearly based on the technologies that's there. So it's we don't cut that between like PLCs and Windows servers and workstations, right? We actually look more at the dependencies of which what each side actually needs, because we need servers and workstations that are connected to these industrial control processes. So yeah, so we do that delineation or a demarcation point with a perimeter between IT and OT, right? Wherever it makes the most sense, where we have probably the fewest connections, the fewest dependencies, because one of the defenses we do if we're under cyber attack is we do what we call an islanding, where we sever either all communications or partial communications. It can be like a leveled version of islanding. To be able to safeguard OT and be able to continue running the processes while we're dealing with a threat inside of the IT. You know, it's kind of like Colonial Pipeline a few years ago, right? Yeah. Instead of shutting down the pipeline, we island instead. We buffer information on each side so we can eventually remerge that, which is something they didn't have in place at the time, but they do now.
Yeah, and that's mostly because the systems that these industrial control systems are involved in running are extremely expensive to shut down and start up, and you know, like one day of downtime is $10 million kind of thing, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, you're often approaching, for a lot of these large industrial companies, we're approaching, you know, the cost that it would be for Amazon if Amazon was to lose their servers for a couple hours,
right? And they also, I've heard circumstantially, there's a lot of older technology running in these environments as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I would say probably the oldest Microsoft product that I've actually found, and I found this as recent as 2022, was DOS version 3.
Oh, my goodness. DOS. Yeah. I was bracing for XP, but you're going full DOS.
Oh, no. The good news is DOS version 3 didn't support networking. So this was actually one of those rare cases. It was truly air-gapped. Everybody talks about air-gapping. In reality, we don't have most of the air-gapping that people think we do, or even the engineers think that we do inside of the OT world. But yeah, this one was truly air-gapped. It didn't support networking at all.
Is that one of the big challenges in securing these environments, or is there other aspects that make them challenging compared to, you know, like an IT environment?
No, I think one of it is the outdated systems that's there. We just naturally tend to have a lot older systems because we'll have a process that's actually put into place, and that process is expected to be able to live for 15, 20 years. You get in a nuclear, it's like 30 to 50 years, right? Oh, wow. And when these were originally put in place, there wasn't a lot of foresight of thinking, oh, well, we may need to actually upgrade some components along the way. So quite often they wrote policies and safety standards to really lock down all of it for that lifespan. We're trying to address that now with all the new processes so we can actually have refresh cycles, but that wasn't in place back then. And the problem is once you do something that's like a, you know, multi-million, multi-billion dollar process, right? How do you go back and recreate all that and figure out, well, what can we do to, you know, make changes to that? So age is one issue of it. Another big problem is because when we lock them down, we can't necessarily patch them in many cases, because a patch actually changes the operational, the operational capabilities of the device itself. And when you're looking at an industrial control system is probably more, for people in IT, the easiest way to think about an industrial control system, think about it as like a computer or like your laptop, right? The components on your laptop are actually all connected together on your motherboard with some level of inherent trust. And we don't really have a lot of security capabilities between the chips on our motherboards. We're actually adding that because it's needed, but they were designed with this inherent trust, just like our industrial control systems were designed with that inherent trust. It's just that in the industrial control systems, these are actually full-blown computers and embedded systems and everything else. The other big problem besides patching, which has been problematic, is not being able to install endpoint security protections like EDR on these devices, because once again, once we've actually commissioned them, which is the formal process of doing testing to put them into production, once they've been commissioned, often they are going to be running for many, many times for many years during that process in many cases.
Interesting. Yeah. And you touched on something there that I've heard from other folks that are more on the academic side, like space systems and stuff. Uh-huh. I think the kind of people that build these systems and stuff are just sort of trusting by nature. And so without having experienced, you know, a lot of cyber intrusions and attacks and stuff, they build these things with a lot of trust in the way they're designed, like no encryption and in just sort of open communication over the wire and stuff like that. So
no, definitely true. And that, but that's what we did in IT as well, right? Originally mm-hmm. IT was all about functionality and enabling businesses. And cybersecurity came, you know, later, and that's yeah. more, that's what's happening inside of OT. It's just that we're, you know, a little bit 10 years behind the, behind the ball. Behind on that.
So what are the most common vulnerabilities you see when assessing these ICS environments? Like what makes them vulnerable to attack?
Well, because we don't have a lot of endpoint security protections on these industrial control systems, we're overly dependent upon network defenses, right? If you can't change the endpoints, you have embedded devices I can't even install any hardening capabilities on or any endpoint security. And then I have workstations and servers that, you know, I can't patch. And I can't harden, at least the older ones. We're definitely doing that on the newer systems that are you know coming on board now. But when we can't do that, right, we have to basically shift our cybersecurity defenses out a layer, and that's to the network layer. And so what we're primarily doing, most of our defenses are all about trying to create multiple different security zones and wrap some type of an enforcement boundary around each of these different security zones. So one around all of OT altogether, and then going through and trying to do the supervision, right? The SCADA systems, the supervisory systems, yep. Trying to wrap them in their own security zone. And then each of the major processes wrap them in their own security zones. And to some degree, maybe even some sub security zones, you know, below that as well. So that's where most of the defenses are, which means most of our weaknesses and vulnerabilities that we're dealing with usually are around those network defenses that are there. Other than that, it's just, you know, continually adding the cybersecurity capability we generally have in IT, trying to add that to our OT systems as well and making them more hardened, having design schemes where we can actually patch them and have more robust business processes where we can actually have upgrade and refresh cycles where we can make changes to them and setting appropriate tests that we can revalidate the system so we can put it back into production when needed.
When penetration testing these systems, do you have to be extra careful that you don't actually shut things off and cause your own problems just by poking the bear?
Yep, very much so. Yeah, when we do a penetration test inside of OT, it while we are generally using a lot of the same tools, we are being much more careful. So, you know, think like delicate white gloves times two on yeah. what we're actually doing. So most of the penetration testing that we're doing, we end up usually hitting the perimeter pretty hard because, right, the attackers are hitting the perimeter pretty hard.
Right.
As we get deeper and deeper, we're being more and more careful, doing less and less. When we get all the way down to the actual industrial control processes themselves, where the PLC is, where the controllers are controlling the system, quite often what we're doing there is we're not doing the active exploitation at that point. We're actually identifying the processes. We're identifying the protocols that are there and any weaknesses inside of the protocol. But if we can simply verify, I actually can see that the protocol's open and interact with the protocol to any degree, even just a port scan to see that the port's open, right? Mm-hmm. And using very special settings for port scanning because Nmap space IP address, right, can actually knock out some of these really old systems, mostly the older ones, but
yeah.
So if we can identify the ports even open and verify the services there, that's generally considered end game because a lot of the Fieldbus protocols and SCADA protocols, these protocols don't really have authentication or cryptographic protection. So if you can prove you can get to it, we should be assuming that whatever an engineer can do with that interface, an attacker can do as well. So, and we don't need to verify that.
Right. It becomes largely academic when you're yep. looking at the very end of it.
Hey, it's Nicole from the Lima Charlie marketing team. Many security teams deal with tool sprawl, dozens of different solutions that create gaps in visibility and slow down response times. Our SecOps Cloud platform consolidates your security stack into a unified platform where everything works together. Lima Charlie gives you comprehensive endpoint visibility and automated response capabilities in milliseconds instead of minutes, so you can stop threats before they spread across your environment. Try our scalable infrastructure for your security services for free at limacharlie.io.
We do a lot of news on the show as well, and I can see it observationally, but like over the past decade or so, it seems like the amount of focus on industrial systems as far as like nation state attackers and just the realization of the security threat they represent is being bubbling up. Are you seeing that in the real world, like through your career, or is it just sort of the management layer, or are you actually seeing these attacks increase in real life?
No, we definitely are seeing them increase in real life. I think that, you know, ever since like the late 2000s, when we had Conficker back in 2008, take out a lot of the IT systems. Conficker actually took out a lot of OT systems as well, because we didn't have perimeter set up between IT and OT at the time. And through the early 2000s and late 90s, the goal was to actually try to get our IT systems to control and get better data to enable the businesses from the control systems. So they were pretty flat networks back then. Mm-hmm. And Conficker took out tons of processes. So that was kind of the awareness. And then Stuxnet came around in 2010. And that was like, oh, wow, this can be used for warfare purposes as well. Ever since then, I think it's been in the mindset of most of the people controlling these networks and governments and you know, big organizations. But I think the general awareness for the public is growing more and more and more over time. I think the news media is actually triggering on some of these stories more. And we definitely are seeing more attacks being done by nation states, being used with warfare, right? Mm-hmm. Currently going on in Iran right now, what's been going on in Ukraine for the last 10 years, because you know, Ukraine's been being smashed by Russia ever since 2014 when it comes to cybersecurity attacks. But yeah. It's definitely becoming more widespread for the people that's out there, and we are seeing more attacks.
Yeah, it makes me think of the power grid attack in Ukraine, where it was actually they were flipping the transformers back and on and off so much that it would have actually caused kinetic damage and destroyed the power plant, but they were able to sort of shut it down. Why is the security grid such a major focus when we are concerned about this?
Like, why is the electric grid?
It seems to be like a major focus of ICS security when we hear governments and agencies talk about, you know.
Honestly, I don't think it's the biggest focus. Maybe it is one of the larger focuses. I think that's definitely fair to say. But I think from the public's perspective, it becomes probably the biggest focus, more because it's the easiest for the public to visualize what the impact is to them. Because all of us, when we lose power, all of us know the immediate effect on us when we lose power at our house. And it's always going to be a major inconvenience that's there.
Right.
So that's something we're all very acutely aware of. And if we think of that at scale, right, we can imagine the chaos that comes from that. It's a lot harder for the general public to think of the same thing on water systems. It's still very possible, you know, somebody poisoning the water systems that are there. But at the same time, it's not necessarily as immediate, because we don't necessarily lose water at our houses very, very often.
Right.
And same thing with like oil and gas, right? All of these things we can visualize. It's just that it's that electric grid is the most visceral, right, that we actually really feel emotionally.
Right. So, you know, back to the grid here, as we move towards a smart grid technology, I know in my house, we've got some new fancy meters and in like the everything's getting more intelligent. Like, does that increase the attack surface of these, or does it actually make it more secure in your opinion?
So it definitely does increase the attack surface, right? Even when we look at any computer system, when we add cybersecurity features, right, and defenses to a system, that is technically increasing the attack surface, because we can attack those cybersecurity features that are there, but we're hoping those cybersecurity features are mitigating other risks, right? So yeah, so the attack surface increases, but the mitigation is kind of, you know, helping as well. When it comes down to smart meters, I would say that there are risks that are present there wasn't before, right? There is an attack that we can do in an electric utility to literally shut down power at the smart meter at each one of our homes, which wasn't present before. So that definitely is a bigger attack surface. However, I think we also gain a lot better visibility. We gain a lot better reporting, right? When we have outages, one of the benefits of the smart meters and why electric utilities wanted to do it is when we have a blackout, they traditionally will know at the substations where power exists and where power doesn't exist. But if there's some type of a line device or a group of homes, right, that are isolated without power, they have no visibility to that. And the smart meters are one of the benefits to do that real-time reporting. So they have real-time exactly each house where power is in and where power's, you know, not in for the grid itself. So there are definitely business benefits we're all benefiting from. We just not necessarily, you know it. So.
All right. Interesting. Yeah, I have a friend who does a lot of research in like radio spectrums and stuff, and he actually was able to, you know, is probably a privacy leak, but like see the water consumption of all his neighbors by monitoring their smart grids.
Yeah. And that's generally going to be the older meters that are there for a lot of those systems, right? A lot of the newer ones actually have decent cybersecurity capabilities. You know, there's still going to be vulnerabilities and weaknesses, but honestly, some of the cybersecurity defenses that have been put in some of the electric grid smart meters that are there, actually are probably some of the best cybersecurity we have inside of the OT world altogether, more so than PLCs. When you look at their authentication schemes and authentication tokens that are actually there, with some of the cryptography that's actually been placed in maintaining and managing those systems.
Very cool. So you've taught ICS security for many years. What are the most important things security professionals need to understand before working in these environments?
Oh boy. I think the biggest thing that we need to understand is just be aware of that while we are trying to build defenses and stop attackers from literally killing people, right? Because that's one of the biggest differences inside of OT is the risk simply is different, where we're talking about loss of limb, loss of life, right? Impacts to society, impacts to nations. So while our defenses are trying to prevent attackers from accomplishing these goals, I think one thing we need to understand is that as defenders, our actions can actually cause some of these same negative consequences if we do things improperly, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest thing is while a lot of what we do inside of OT looks like what we do in IT security, in fact, I would say about 80% of what we do in OT security is you know, pretty darn close to what we do inside of IT security. There's a 20% difference that is significant and little teeny tweaks, little teeny changes that if we don't realize that and understand that and get that implemented inside of the OT systems and treat OT as its own requirements and don't try to treat it like we treat an IT network security program, right? If we don't do that separately, we can actually, like I said, cause the same things, the same problems right. that we're trying to prevent.
Right. So if somebody, like a lot of our listeners are sort of starting their career, if somebody wants to specialize in ICS security, what are the kind of things they should be doing along the way to kind of steer themselves in that direction?
So I think just like any field inside of cybersecurity, right? Cybersecurity by itself never exists by itself. Cybersecurity is always applied to some type of technological system, right? So you can specialize in cybersecurity for web applications, for cloud-based security, for Active Directory, right? So my recommendation is that if you want to specialize in doing cybersecurity for an OT systems, you have to gain understanding of the underlying technologies. So you're going to have to learn to go through and actually understand what a PLC is and try programming a PLC and see how it interacts with the environment, see how it actually interacts with the SCADA systems and the HMIs, and understand at least a basic understanding of the underlying technology that's there. I mean, you don't have to be an expert programmer or engineer to be able to do it, just like you don't have to be a developer to do cybersecurity on top of a web application, but you have to have basic understanding that's there. So I would say focus on your general cybersecurity knowledge set, because like I said, 80% of it is directly applicable. Focus on trying to gain the understanding of the underlying systems themselves, buy a couple PLCs, download some virtual machines that are out there that have virtual PLCs that are actually on them, learn the underlying technologies and the protocols, and then start trying to merge the two together. And when you want to start trying to do this professionally, right? Definitely read a lot of the information that's out there. There's a lot of free resources that are out there on YouTube. You know, look at NIST 882. There's a lot of other guidance documents that are out there that is put out by multiple different nations around the world. I have a lot of the free ones actually on my virtual machine open source project called Control Things Platform. So you can go grab that at controlthings.io. You can even find just the repository on GitHub if you want just the guidance documents that are there. But yeah, that's a lot of free resources. You don't have to go do a class, but if you want to shortcut your learning, right, it's kind of the benefits of the classes. And that's why I have my class at Black Hat and my class at the SANS Institute as well.
And like all things in cybersecurity, you have to do the work.
Yeah, you know, you definitely have to do the work. No, definitely true. And then decide what area you want, because there's tons of areas you can specialize inside of here as well, just like there is in lots of different cybersecurity professional roles that you can have in IT. A lot of those same roles exist inside of OT as well. So just trying to identify exactly where your niche is. And, you know, my two courses kind of focus on the two basics, you know, basic lines. My Black Hat class called Assessing Exploiting Industrial Control Systems, that one's focused more on the penetration testing side. And we've been running that at Black Hat now for 13 going on 14 years. My SANS course is called ICS 410. And 410 is really more about cybersecurity for practitioners. What do we do for cybersecurity to apply that as a defender for that environment and try to teach you kind of the landscape that's there for cybersecurity?
So AI is obviously something that we talk a lot about on the show.
Get rid of it now.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I'm actually giving a talk in Regina of all places next week on it, and just like the explosion, the exponential growth and stuff. So, you know, it's completely changing how we see security on our side of things from an infrastructure perspective. How do you see AI automating or influencing ICS security in the coming years?
Honestly, ever since the very beginning, my stance on any type of AI technology, and I'm a heavy consumer, heavy researcher inside of it. In fact, I have a little Mac studio here with 512 gigs of RAM for my research platform to be able to run local LLMs. And I've actually been working on a big project with Oak Ridge National Labs I'm a co-author on one of their papers about using AI for cybersecurity and industrial control systems for identification and vulnerability assessments, and to some degree, a little bit of exploitation. But so I'm a huge proponent of AI, a heavy user of AI. But at the same time, to me, AI just is that next evolution in our technological tools that we use as humans, right? Mm-hmm. To me, it's the same thing when we went to industrialization that really kind of added efficiency to humans' works and basically allowed a single human to be able to amplify what that single human was able to do with industrialization. Computers did the same thing. I think AI is just really doing that same thing. Greater amplification for each individual for what we can actually accomplish, but at the same time, taking away jobs and creating new jobs at the same time. So I don't really foresee it being a huge thing. I think it can benefit defenders just as much as attackers. I don't think there's any special secret sauce that compared to IT that's already been discussed. So
everything's just getting faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any emerging technologies in industrial environments that worry you from a security perspective, like any paths where things are going? I know robotics are obviously taking a bigger and bigger role.
Yeah, no, the robotics are interesting. And we actually have some really interesting protocols that have come online with some of the new robotics that are there. Some of the new advances inside of Ethernet that we actually have with a lot of the two-wire protocols, so one twisted pair. So if you haven't looked into that, a lot of really neat Ethernet standards that are actually come out. Ethernet APL, which is a new partnership between IEEE and the industry, that's actually adding what we call intrinsic safety to Ethernet, basically making it so that it's sparkless and can't combust a combustible environment, which is kind of important for chemical manufacturing.
Yeah.
But yeah, in general, I don't think there's anything that's concerning. I've never been somebody that's really been afraid of the new technologies. I'm always looking to see the best way to apply it to avoid the risks, but also trying to identify where the benefits are from that. I think a lot of people over the last 10 years have expressed a lot of concern about moving to cloud. I've always been one that said, hey, that should be a red flag, but that shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction responding with no, right? So I don't really have concerns of it. Maybe the bigger concerns is the application of new technologies without a lot of planning or foresight into addressing the risks that are there. I think that's my biggest fear is the lack of human awareness and lack of human due diligence, right, in the application than necessarily the technology themselves.
Are you saying that in the race to the market that people might make some bad security decisions?
No, not at all. Not at all. Companies aren't going to ever purchase something and never hire people to actually run the tool, right? Or do checkbox security. No, that doesn't ever happen. Yeah. And we never hire professionals that simply don't have the skill set, and we never discover they don't have the skill set because we're not properly oversighting the groups and the efforts. So
yeah, it does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day sometimes, you know, with AI. That's really, like, again, I agree with you, we're all in, we're very optimistic about it, but just seeing the how fast some of it's getting rolled out without proper oversight, but that's kind of the way things work.
The hype wave is real.
Yeah.
We are so stuck in the middle of that hype wave. There are so many amazing, great capabilities for these, but the hype of some of the problems that it's magically going to solve, as well as some of the problems it's creating to magically create some of these problems, like world dominance. Yeah, there's definitely some extremists on both sides of that fence there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. All right, so this is the last one I have for you. It's the one I ask of everybody that comes onto the show. It can be as wide or as narrow as you want. Okay. I use it in a summary show at the end of the year where we put them all together. Nice. Do you have any predictions for the future of cybersecurity?
Predictions for the future of cybersecurity?
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah, world domination by AI overlords. It's going to replace all of our world order by the 2050, let's say.
That's it.
Very good.
All right, we'll take it. Thanks so much for coming to talk to us. Is there anything, I know you mentioned your repo on GitHub with some resources for folks. Is there anything you want to leave them with to go if they want to learn more about what you do and maybe get in touch?
Yeah, probably just point them over to controlthings.io. That's my main website. Okay. There's links to the GitHub repository. There's links to all my projects. There's links to my classes there.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks so much, Justin.
And that brings us to the end of another great conversation. You can support our show by sharing your favorite episode with a friend, subscribe, give us a rating, or leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.